Parshas Ekev Tavshin Samaches. Today we are going to divide our time between some philosophy born out of a very important pasuk, one that we're all exceedingly familiar with. That's on page 994, Parshas Ekev, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vahaya Im Shamoa, that's from the Shema. And we will also spend time in a historical journey, I guess, back into the time of the Chorban, of the days of Yavne, the days of Beitar, the days of Hadrian, and explore how our sages, how our leaders at that time understood the requirements of loving Hashem with all your heart and all your soul, and listening at all costs, and the importance of the law, the obedience to the law, and the legacy they left for us, and what they did for us at that time, and how astonishing their behavior was compared to the behavior of any other people in any other culture. So we're starting with this pasuk, Vahaya Im Shamoa. Now, right here on this pasuk, and you know the context, if you listen, the rain will fall and your crops will grow, and then you'll be able to gather in all of your crops in peace and in health, then your children will be healthy, and there won't be war on your borders, and you'll be prosperous, and things will go well, and things will go easy. But if you don't listen, the land will spit you out, etc. And we've spoken about the mitzvahs included in the Shema, mezuzah, tefillin, and teaching your children, and how they remain for us relics, reminders of the lost kavod, and in a form of encouragement for us. But we're going to speak about these mitzvahs again in a different light. The Mesiras Nefesh displayed by our leaders for Mezuzah, Tefillin, and Talmud Torah. But here's how we start. In the Meseches Brachos, Rav Shimon ben Yochai, and we will speak about Rav Shimon ben Yochai because he was one of those who was Moser Nefesh also. Right? He was in the cave for 13 years. We'll talk about the events that led to his needing to hide for all those years from the Romans. And Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, when Klal Yisrael, Osin Ritzono Shel Makom, they do what Hashem wants, then Malachta Naset Al Yidei Acherim, then all their work is done by others. They are going to be free to just learn Torah and engage in the mitzvot and become scholars and intellectuals, philosophers, and everybody else will take care of everything. And they'll do so willingly and happily. It's because they'll understand the importance of what the sages are doing and the scholars, and they'll take the burdens of everything else off their hands. And he quotes a pasuk to prove this from Yeshayahu, "Va'amdu zarim v'ra'utzonchem," and strangers will come and shepherd your sheep for you, and you'll be able to focus entirely on the intellectual pursuits. "Ubizman she'ein Yisrael osin ritzon al shemakom," but when they're not pleasing Hashem that much and they're not doing the ritzon Hashem, now this you're not going to be prepared for. So then their work, melachta nasid al yidei atzman, they have to do their work themselves, as it says, v'yasafta digonecha, from this parsha in Shema. V'haya im Shema, if you listen, then everything will be good, and your rain will fall, v'yasafta digonecha, and you'll gather your produce, which we always think is a huge bracha. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai now is saying, that's when we're not up to par, and we have to gather our own crops, and we have to be the farmers, and we don't have time to learn. That's how he's reading it. And our question begins with, where does he get that from? That this is actually some type of a criticism. Right? Vayim shemoa tishmuel mitzvos, sayasher nochi mitzav eschem hayom. If you do listen to love Hashem, to serve Him with b'chol levavchem u'b'chol nafshechem, v'nasati mitar artzchem, I'll let the rain fall, be'ito in its right time, yoreh malkush, the different types of rain, v'yasafta digancha, v'siroshcha, v'yitzarecha. So Rav Shimon bar Yochai doesn't see this as all positive at all. He says this isn't the highest level. And of course, the Das Zakenim of Bali Tosfos asks this basic question, which is obvious to all of us, that we always assume that this is speaking about when Klal Yisrael are doing what's right in Hashem's eyes, and He's rewarding us with the bountiful crops. So we have to figure out what this means. So my grandfather, Rav Schwab, brings down an idea here, which he speaks about often, and it's the essence of Yirah Shemayim, the concept which defines Yirah Shemayim, which is the idea that there is a huge difference between having a view of one's obligation to the Torah and mitzvot as something that one chooses to abide by, or having a totally different view, which is that keeping the mitzvot is totally, it's what we call muchrach. It's axiomatic. It's not like we have a choice whether we should keep the mitzvot or we don't keep the mitzvot. It's as if somebody's standing at the edge of the Empire State Building and somebody says to them, look, you have a choice here. You can jump off or you don't have to. There is no choice. When the results are so obvious, it's self-evident. It's axiomatic that there's only one way to conduct oneself. And as long as we imagine that there's a choice whether or not we're going to keep the mitzvot, then it indicates that we have not yet at all changed our mindset to a place where we wouldn't even, we would laugh at ourselves for thinking that we can decide whether, as if there's an option that we could keep the mitzvot or we can't keep the mitzvot. And the truth is, the hint to that, my grandfather says, is right in the first three words. Vahaya im shamoa, if you choose. So that's what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is really feeling. That's what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is really commenting on. Once the Torah sets it up here, Moshe says to the people, and if you choose, everything will go well, but make no mistake about it. That is so far from a whole different mindset, and it implies something pejorative. The fact that we can relate to this with an if you choose. There can be no if. It has to be muchrach, absolute, positive, as if without it we're dead, without it we have no point to life, we don't want to live, we give our lives away automatically without any type of inner conflict, because there is no life without our Torah and our mitzvot. Now, if you flip back to V'yetzchanan, page 960, and you look at Pasuk Vav, this is also part of Moshe's speech telling us about the importance of the mitzvot. And he says, "Ushamartem v'yasisem," and preserve them, guard them, which always refers to a lo sase. Shomer is to watch that nothing violates this sacrosanct territory of this particular halacha. Make sure nothing violates it. Keep everything that can damage this behavior away. Okay, maintain a particular thought process or behavior process and don't do anything that will violate it. That's ushamartem, guard. V'asisem, that's ases, all the mitzvahs that have to be done. Now look at the next words. Ki hi chachmaschem ubinaschem le'enei ha'amim. Because it, that's a singular, is your chachma and your bina in the eyes of the nation. Asher yishmun es kol achukim ha'ela, and they will hear about all these lifestyles, statutes, these behaviors, these mitzvahs for Amru, and they'll say, rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh. What a smart, insightful nation this is. Now, our question here is on the word he. Moshe is telling Kal Yisrael, preserve them. Watch carefully. He puts the lo sases first. Do not violate them under any circumstances, and do what you have to do. And you should keep all of these mitzvot, ki hi chachmatchem, because it is your chachma. Now, if we're talking about the mitzvot, we should have said ki heim chachmatchem, because they are your wisdom. By the way, just a side point here. Shamartem v'yasisem, lo sases and ases. The halacha is, for a mitzvot ase, you have to be willing to spend one-fifth, 20% of your assets to fulfill a mitzvah's ase, and if the cost of the ase is more than one-fifth of your assets, you're putter. But not to violate a los ase, it's b'chol modecha, every penny, b'chol nafshecha, right, every single penny, and sometimes in times of shmad, it's b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, even if you have to give up your life. But certainly in regular times, not to violate a los ase means all your money. So let me give you an example. My grandfather used to say, somebody's at work in a job, and the boss comes over and says, just sign this document here. And by signing that, a person is over lo signo. Don't steal, because it's a dishonest piece of paper. It misrepresents the truth. and the employee understands it, that he can't sign. So he has to be willing to lose his job, be kicked out of his house, the house has to go into foreclosure, etc., etc. In other words, b'chol ma'odecha really means with everything, you can't be over a lo sase. But with the mitzvahs aseh, it's 20%. So for example, if a person has X amount of money in there, they have to buy an esrog and it costs more than a fifth, they're pater. Okay? So what Moshe is telling us, shumartam v'asisem, guard lo sases and ases, ki hi chachmaschem. Our question is, what does the word he mean? Because it. But you're talking about the mitzvos, the many mitzvos, but it has to be something from the pasuk. Heshi, my husband suggests, and many people have heard this and believe that this is true, and it explains how we operate our whole philosophical system and our legal system, how we perceive the law. And the law becomes very important here because we're going to be speaking about the Mesiras Nefesh for the law. What is the he? Because he chachmaschem, not the mitzvos. The mitzvos would be haim. The doing of the mitzvos and the refusal to violate the mitzvos, right? The asiya, that is your chachma. Now how is that? Shamartam v'asisim. The fact that you do the mitzvos, that is your chachma, the asiya. Most governments, including this wonderful country, most governmental systems work like this. Let's say in America, a number of great people, as our founding fathers were, came together and concocted a concept. They imagined a concept of a new type of government by the people and for the people. They imagined a concept of democracy and liberty. And once they had this idea in mind, they went ahead to create a constitution to set up a way to make sure that those ideas could be implemented. So then they wrote laws. They wrote laws, and the laws were designed to ensure that the idea that they had imagined could be preserved. So the laws were an outgrowth of the concept. Okay, does Judaism work like this? Does Judaism work like this? No, think about it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us and put us around Har Sinai and told us laws, not speeches, not philosophies, laws. And the Jewish people understood that by living according to these laws, even if they make no sense, which are the chukim, and in the end, by the way, all our mitzvos are chukim. Even the logical ones, maybe on the surface, they have some type of a tam. They're palatable. They make a little sense. But when you dig down, they all have elements to them which are chukim, which don't have any rational basis. So much of what identifies us as Jews is chukim, kashrus, taras ha-mishpacha. Shabbos is an edus, a testimony, but it's also in the category of chukim and all the 39 melachas. Everything is chukim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, here is a body of laws, just do them. And when you live according to the law, you will notice miraculously that you become a certain kind of a person. And your interactions with your neighbors take on a certain nature. And by dealing fairly, And by accepting the decision of, let's say, an authority, then you become a patient people and a compromising people and a peace-loving people. By following the halachas, our national character emerges and we discover it ourselves. We discover what the halacha does for us. Our philosophy, our lifestyle, our vision is born out of the law. Whether we understand the law or not, it changes the person and the person becomes something of a different nature. For example, none of our bubbies rang a chicken's neck with their own hands. We don't eat birds of prey and wild animals, and we're not a war-making people. And we don't have war songs filling up our literature like the Romans, like every other culture. And we don't revere war heroes, and not every child is aiming to be a soldier like it was in cultures for thousands of years. We're not death-oriented. We don't eat black pudding, which is blood, which is a delicacy in London, in England. We are not a people that tortures other people. We're not murderers. Where does it come from? Because we have a philosophy? No, because we abide by laws, and that changes our nature. So we understood how the law is everything. whether people understand the importance of the law at that particular time in their life, whether they don't understand it, abiding by the law is our lifeline, and it becomes, makes us who we are. And that's a secret of the Jewish people, and it's entirely different than any other nation in the way any nation is built. Period. I was just had someone in my house a couple of weeks ago, and she had a very hard time understanding why her brother, who's a Baal Tshuva, refused at all costs to join them at a family party in a treif restaurant. She couldn't understand the sensitivity, the fact that if he doesn't want to eat, and I tried to explain to her that the law that we stay away from not kosher food is so important to us that it supersedes other people's feelings, and it supersedes, you know, trying to make shalom. He doesn't want to eat treif, and he doesn't want to see his Jewish family eating treif, whether they understand it or not, because the law to us is monumentally important. And that doesn't make us, like the Christians try to portray it, love versus law. Their whole religion, much of their philosophy is that they came to improve. We are people of the law, and therefore we're strict and cruel, whereas they're people of love, who embrace humanity more. Our law doesn't make us strict and cruel. Our law makes us the kind-hearted, compromising, peace-loving people that we are. The people that love everybody else. We're the least warlike people on earth. So the law is everything. And here when we go back to the Shema, Vahaya im Shemoa, if you choose, the very fact that it says if already implies that we don't have the deepest understanding of the absolute, axiomatic, the absolute, sense that the law is our life and there really is nothing to choose or to debate about it. Now here my grandfather brings examples of three sages that for mitzvahs aseh, mezuzah, Tefillin and Talmud Torah were ready to put their lives on the line in a time of Shmad, in a time where this is necessary because the Goyim are trying to wipe out Judaism, because they understood that there's absolutely no life without the mitzvahs. And he brings down first the story of Rabbi Akiva teaching Torah in public and Pappas Ben Yehuda saying to him, how could you do this? And Rabbi Akiva giving the example of the fish in the water. But let's give a little background to understand this conversation. And let's remember that this conversation took place in prison, where Rabbi Akiva and Pappas Ben Yehuda were imprisoned by the Romans. Let's give a little bit of background here. Rabbi Akiva was already alive at the time of the Chorban. And at the time of 40 years before the Chorban, the Sanhedrin had already disbanded. They had no more power, and they had disbanded. They no longer sat in the marble chamber in the Beis HaMikdash Lishchas HaGozes. However, the law and the sages who determined the law were central to the existence of the Jewish people. However, they could no longer enforce the law because the Romans had taken away all power. They had no power of capital punishment. They couldn't do the Sota waters anymore. They couldn't impose death penalties. They couldn't do a lot of things anymore. They were neutralized. They were neutralized not just by the Romans, but inside of Klal Yisrael were many small groups that hated, as you've heard this phrase, the Pharisees, who we call the Prushim, who make this very clear. The Prushim were not a little sect. They were the entire nation, other than the leftover Hellenists, the Herodians, the Notzrim, who became eventually, you know, the Christians. Those were fringe groups. And everybody else were the Prushim. Now, the Prushim were divided up into two groups. They were the Chaverim, which were the Talmidei Chachamim, and they were the Amei Haaretz. Now today, we use the term Am Haaretz, and it's like pejorative. He doesn't know anything, it's an Am Haaretz. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it was a whole different connotation to the term Am Haaretz. So much of Torah is batal today. That's really bittul Torah, when so many halachas don't apply. Right? And a huge amount of halachas. The whole body of law that no longer applies is Tumah and Tahara. There were so many halachas applying to how, what you could eat, where you could eat, when you were tummy, when you were tahar, how you made yourself tahar, how you came to the Beis HaMikdash, what you could touch, what you couldn't touch. The laws were an enormous body of laws. Not everybody knew them all. The problem was that the people who didn't know these laws were in danger of basically being metame, the whole nation, by touching something tummy, going into a place where the tumah could spread, not telling people that they were tumah, touching the people's vessels. If people took those vessels into other places, before you knew it, it was like a spiritually contagious thing. The whole nation could be matama. People could be coming to the Beis HaMikdash tumah. It was a huge worry. So the way it worked is that anyone who was a Talmud Chacham who knew the halachas of Tum and Tahara, which didn't just apply to women, men, also women, they were among the sages, among the educated ones. Anyone who didn't have the time to learn because of family circumstances or abilities knew that they were not well-versed in the laws of Tum and Tahara, and they identified themselves as the Am Ha'aretz, and they were very careful to inform the Talmid Chachamim in every town what they had touched and where they had been and what they had done, so that they could be told how to handle things and they wouldn't throw the whole country into a balagan of complete confusion with Tumah. So the Amei Haaretz respected the Talmid Chachamim. They were very jealous, because to be a Talmid Chacham was the only thing anyone aspired to, other than the secularists who were abandoning Torah, who wanted to be like the Romans. But other than that, the only thing anyone wanted to be was a Talmud Chacham. And in fact, it seems to be that the secularists only made inroads with some of the very wealthy who wanted power and position. Like, we know the Notzrim made no inroads with anybody. They had to go to Rome. They had a very hard time getting any Jews to follow their ways. But the Amei Haaretz were jealous of the Talmid Chachamim in a good kind of a way, and they were very conscious to always inform the Talmid Chachamim of where they were at, what they had done. And so they kept themselves, they knew themselves as Amei Haaretz. Once there was no Beis HaMikdash anymore, this whole thing went away. And it really didn't matter whether you were Talmud Chacham or Am Haaretz, because everyone could learn Torah the same way. There were no more Tumas and Taras. Rabbi Akiva, remember him? He was among the Amei Haaretz. Huge. He was till 40. He said, if I saw Talmud Chacham, I would bite him like a donkey and crush his bones. There was so much animosity to the fact that he wasn't one of them. But he became one of them. Now, at this time, in the time of the Chorban, the people had to band together. Not only did they band together because this didn't separate them anymore, but the people that still wanted to abide by the Torah after the Chorban had to band together. And the only thing they had no political power, they had no Beis HaMikdash, they had no Malchus Beis David, they had no Kohanim, nothing was left. The only thing that held them all together as a nation was their commitment to the Torah and the mitzvahs. But it was a free-for-all. Everybody was running. Thousands were taken away to Rome. Hundreds of thousands. People were murdered. People were taken as slaves. People were taken to be thrown into the wild animals in the Colosseum, which was built by the Flavian family in the year 70 at the time of the Chorban. Why do you think it was built? It seems that it was built for the Jews, who came down there en masse, tens and thousands of them, to be thrown to the animals. By the way, Josephus called himself Flavius. That's from Vespasian, the Flavian, who was in charge of destroying the Beis HaMikdash. It's not exactly impressive that he took the name of the emperor. The Flavian family is Vespasian, his son Titus, and the third one, and after him, Domitian. Okay, then comes Hadrian, who we're going to speak about, who's not from that family, who was the worst of all. But it was that family that built the Colosseum in Rome, and till today on the Colosseum you can still see it engraved, the family of Flavius that built it. In any case, the people had to band together, but the Chachamim of that time understood that the only thing that will hold these people together with no more trappings is the Torah and the mitzvot. There was one problem, that up until this time not all the halacha had been established. There were still machlokasim, mainly between Hillel and Shammai, different ways of doing things, different approaches, and not everything had been resolved as one derech. And the Chachamim of that era understood, specifically Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we'll speak about, that if they don't organize right now, in the few years they have left after the Chorban, because they didn't know what would happen, and it only took about 50-60 years until Beitar fell and then everything was over, but in those years they had to bequeath to the Jewish people a written document that told everybody what the halacha was, how to live by the halacha, which didn't exist yet. Okay, now what happened? Up until that time, nothing had been allowed to be written other than Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim. So, you know how we have computers today? They had people of exceptional memory who basically became living books. And they would memorize Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, and all the Mishnayos, which was the oral law, Baal Peh. And basically, if you needed to look something up, you went over to one of these people and pushed the download button, and they were able to tell you, just recite for you what you needed to know. And there's a whole thing, by the way, they always caution these people not to paskin. They're just memorizers. They're not allowed to make decisions. That wasn't their skill, and they weren't trained just to memorize. They were living books. So at that time, though, the people were running and the people were dispersing, and they understood that there's got to be a centralized decision by the remaining sages to put the halacha down in a book for everybody to have with them. And that's eventually how the Mishnah became written. Now, the Mishnah was written in the year 200. It was sealed by Rebbe, but this process started in Yavne in the year 70 after the Churban. So that's 130 years. Now, who's responsible for Yavne? The man responsible for Yavne is Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. That name is huge. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, or Rambam. That's the list. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that without anything left of the national trappings, you know, everything we had as a nation to centralize us, there had to be, as we said, a consensus on the halacha. So what he wanted to do was he wanted to gather all remaining sages in one place and finally go over every existing machlokas and decide on it and close it. Mostly between Hillel and Shammai. There were tons of machlokas between Hillel and Shammai. Just to go through all of them, it took years, by the way, and decide on everyone and call an end to them, to the discrepancies. So he went to Vespasian, who was besieging Yerushalayim, and he called him emperor, and Vespasian became upset, and then Yochanan ben Zakkai said, no, but you will be emperor. And Vespasian said to him, and you know the whole story, they took him out in a coffin. And when it became true that Vespasian was the emperor, he granted Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai three wishes. Now, what did Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai ask for? He said, save for me Yavne v'chachameha. Don't destroy Yavne and all the scholars sitting there. Now, the fact that Vespasian agreed to this means that, contrary to the way it's depicted in many history books, even Josephus, who was on their side, the sages were not fomenting revolt against the Romans, because if that was true, he wouldn't have saved Yavne and all the Chachamim. He saw them as irrelevant, meaningless people sitting and reading text. He didn't understand their importance. He didn't understand that they were the central heart of the Jewish people. So he granted him Yavne v'chachameha. Then Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai put out a call throughout the land, everybody who has any knowledge come to Yavne. And all the sages converged on Yavne at that time. By the way, very interesting, Elazar ben Arach, you've heard his name once or twice. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had five major students, okay? Two of them, which we will speak about more, was Elazar ben Horkanus and Rav Yoshua ben Chananya. Now, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, if you put all the sages in the world on one side and Rav Elazar ben Horkanus on the other, he will outweigh them, but Elazar ben Arach is greater than all of them. You can imagine. You don't find almost anything, almost zero, about Elazar ben Arach in the writings of the sages in the Mishnah. Where was he? What happened? They blame it on his wife. She never let him go to Yavne. She liked her Roman city with her baths and her this and that, and he never went to Yavne with the other sages. However, compared to this is Rabbi Akiva with Rachel, who turns him into a great sage, and Shaliva Shalachem Shalahi, right? So he called everybody together at Yavne, and they all came en masse. That's when Yavne reached its height. He also asked for the family of Rabbi Gamliel. Now, that was critical, and Romans didn't understand that either. There was nothing left of Malchus Beis David except their family line, and they'd always been loyal leaders of the Jewish people, and he intended to make sure that there'd always be a leader, which they became known as the Nasi, from Beis David, who the people would gather around, and they weren't just administrative leaders, they were Talmid Chachamim, the heads of the Beis Din, the heads of the gathering. And he preserved the line of David, which was huge for the people, that they had a place to go where the sages were, where Torah was, and where David's line was. And he asked for the curing of a great sage just, he, as they say, threw that in to make it seem that his requests were just silly little irrelevant requests, save this one. But that's how we got Yavne. Now, when the sages gathered at Yavne, as we said, their main job was to set down the halacha, to go through all of the various oral traditions and establish the final version of them, because there were certain different, when things are oral, different versions, to establish the final version of them. And that's eventually how you got the Rebbe. The Mishnah, he didn't write the Mishnah, he just organized it and decided what would be included in the Mishnah. Now, while we're getting here, come to the Mesiras Nefesh of the people in Yavne. This was not an easy time for the Jewish people. The Romans were on the lookout, and the Christians, the early Christians, the Nazarenes, were not our friends and were reporting back to the Romans any activity that they could twist and turn and say the Jews are planning a revolt. So the Yavne, they had to run. They were in Yavne for a while. They made some critical decisions there. They ran to Usha. Things really got bad at the time of Hadrian, and that's where the story of Rabbi Akiva and Papas Ben Yehuda takes place. Now, Rabbi Akiva lived to be a very old man. Okay, he was 40 when he started learning. He was 60 at the Chorban, and he lived till about 120. So he lived after the Chorban too, which means he lived till about the year 130, which was smack in the middle of the time of Hadrian. Now, Hadrian didn't know what to do with the Jewish people left in Israel. There were two paths in front of him: squash them completely or tolerate them. And he took basically, with a little wavering, but he took the second path. Now, Hadrian was cruel and vicious, and he decided he's going to completely squash the Jewish people. And the way he decided to do this is Gezeras Hashmad, which led to the fight of Beitar. The Beitar was not a revolt to get back our independence. Beitar was like the Hashmonaim. It was the same thing. It was a time of Shmad. First, he began by forbidding some basic halachas, as you know. He began by forbidding Mila. He began by forbidding Nida and going to the mikvah. Not only did he forbid Mila, but he forced many who had been circumcised to undergo surgery to make them look like they weren't. And when Bar Kokhba came around, they went back and did more surgery to make it look like they were circumcised. Okay? This is what eventually led to the Chachamim realizing that there was no choice. They had to teach Torah. They had to continue the smicha. They had to give smicha. They had to continue the traditions, the halacha, and the would be passed on. And that is how you get to the story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva became not just a sage. The sages at Yavne and then at Usha, they were the government of Klal Yisrael. They made the diplomatic missions to Rome to speak to this emperor or that emperor. They were the ones who traveled to the communities in Rome to strengthen the people, to help them, the captives. They were the people that were known as the leaders. And of course, when therefore the Romans wanted to destroy the leaders, they went after the sages. The sages were the leaders. Rabbi Akiva, at this time, when Hadrian was decreeing all of these anti-religious laws, the Chachamim were in any case still abiding by them. Some of them even publicly. Eventually, there was a huge uprising when Hadrian's decrees got more and more severe. There was a huge uprising, and they rebelled, and they were entirely squashed, defeated at Beitar by Hadrian and his forces. Nobody survived, and there were hundreds of thousands dead who weren't allowed to be buried for 14 years, littering the streets. And later, when they were allowed to be buried, they added a special bracha in the benching. There was a time of Gzeres Hashmad associated with Beitar and the war of Beitar and directly after Beitar. By the way, Hadrian, the emperor, had a relative. Some say he was more related more closely to Titus, who was from the Flavian line, or Hadrian, which was from a different line. But it seems that it's from Hadrian. There was a man named Uncalus. And Uncalus was very impressed by the Jews, and he was sent over, actually, to help build Aelia Capitolina. Now, you know what that is? So if you go to the Cardo in Yerushalayim, you'll see a map of Aelia Capitolina. Hadrian was the emperor that destroyed Yerushalayim. By the way, they plowed it with salt, the Harabias, on Tisha B'Av in order to show the people don't even dream about starting anything new here. And then Hadrian, later on, we're talking about 50 or so years after the Churban, Hadrian destroyed Yerushalayim and rebuilt it according to Roman city, which basically is, streets going lengthwise, streets going widthwise, very organized. That's the Cardo, the Roman streets, the huge pillars, the shops inside. And he named it Aelia Capitolina, and Jews were banned from entering the city for a very, very long time. And Uncalus was one of the architects of Aelia Capitolina, except when he came there, he became so impressed, he converted. And who was he impressed with? So he was impressed with two very important people, of Elazar ben Hyrcanus and Rav Yeshua ben Chananya. Now, let's talk about them for a moment and their association with Yavne, and we'll get back to Rabbi Akiva. This was all pretty much in those years. Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus, as we said, was considered greater than everybody, and Rav Yeshua ben Chananya were students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. One was very rich, one was very poor, and they were upholders of the Torah, and they were among the giants of Yavne. And Uncalus learned from them, and Rabbi Akiva started out as their student, and then became their colleague, and then became everybody's teacher. Okay? And then, when Uncalus came, the Hadrian, or whoever it was, sent delegations to get him back, and one after the other, four times, he convinced the delegations to stay and also convert. And Hadrian told each delegation, go and you're not allowed to speak to him. Okay? And when they finally came to take away Uncalus to share the fate, basically, of every other Jew who insisted on keeping learning Torah, he put his hand on the mezuzah. And people said, what are you doing? And he said, look, in every other nation, the king stays inside and the people protect him from the outside. But here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is protecting the people, and the people are inside. And he was ready to go to his death on the fact that he had a mezuzah and that he insisted on having a mezuzah. Rabbi Akiva was willing to go to his death for teaching Torah in public. And he did. At the time where Hadrian demanded that Torah be forbidden, it was just like any Gzeres HaShmad, like Russia, like the Hellenists, he taught Torah in public. When he ended up in prison, and you can imagine what a Roman prison, what the conditions were, he ended up with Pappas ben Yehuda. Pappas ben Yehuda is the one who said to him, fortunate are you, Akiva, that you are here in prison because of teaching Torah and not for a meaningless reason like me, Pappas ben Yehuda. And Rabbi Akiva then gave him the famous mashal about the fish. The fish are in the water and the fishermen's nets are trying to catch them. And so one smart fox comes and says, you know what, you're going to be caught by the fishermen. Come out of the water here and stay with me. And the fish say to the fox, you're such a fool. Yeah, in the water we have a chance. Maybe we'll evade the nets or maybe we'll get caught, but there's a chance. If we come out of the water, we're dead. That's how Rabbi Akiva saw teaching Torah to the people at that time. That's how Uncalus, who was then commissioned to translate the Torah under the direction of the sages, obviously not on his own, saw the mitzvah of mezuzah. And then there's the story of... this story in the Gemara in Shabbos on 49a Mem Tes Aleph, the story of Elisha Bal Knafayim, Elisha the winged one, same time period. So what was he called the winged one for? Gemara explains the reference to Elisha the winged one. Why was Elisha called the winged one? Because it once happened that the wicked Roman government passed the edict against Israel that anyone who dons tefillin will have his brain gouged out. Okay, this was the time that they lived in. And now Elisha would don them and go out into the marketplace. Now this is a mitzvah aseh, right? But in the time of Shmad, and certainly in this case, he was making a point that he's rather die than not be able to wear the tefillin. So he went out to the marketplace in defiance of this edict. A Roman officer saw him and began to chase him. Elisha fled from him, and the officer caught up with him. Elisha took the tefillin off and held them in his hand. The officer said, what is in your hand? And he said, Kanfei Yona, the birds a dove's wings. The dove's wings. He opens his hand, and there was, there were wings of a dove. Because of this miracle, they called him Elisha, the winged one. And he explains, and this is a song, Mayona. You know that song that's popular today, Mayona? The congregation of Israel is compared to a dove, that just as a dove can only escape because with its wings and is only protected by its wings, so Klal Yisrael only has the commandments, only has the laws, as the only way we can live and we can escape and we can fly. We can't live without our wings. We're lost, and that's it. So you have the story here of Unkelus, of Rabbi Akiva, and Elisha bar Knafaim, just a few, who understood that the law and passing on the law was above all, was paramount, and without the ability of Klal Yisrael to live by the law, we might as well all just commit, you know, national suicide now. That is our heart and our soul. Now, even Josephus says something astonishing, and he says, you know, we've been persecuted for so long, and why do they hate us so much? And he suggests, I venture to say, he says, that no one can tell of not more than one or two that have betrayed our laws, not out of fear of death itself. I do not mean such as an easy death as happens in battles, but that which comes with bodily torments and seems to be the severest death of all. Now I think those who have conquered us have put us to such deaths, not out of their hatred to us when they had subdued us, but rather out of their desire of seeing a surprising sight, which is this. Whether there be such men in the world who believe that no evil is to them so great as to be compelled to do or to speak anything contrary to their own laws. He says, nor ought men to wonder at us if we are more courageous in dying for our laws than all other men are. For other men do not easily, now this one he says, other men do not easily submit to the easier things in which we Jews are instituted. I mean, we are working with our hands instead of making war and despoiling other countries. We are eating moderately, being contented to eat and drink not at random or at pleasure. We have special rules about consorting with our wives, and we observe our time of rest. Others cannot submit to such laws about their ways of living, and certainly nobody would die rather than transgress a Roman law or a French law or any other law that is arbitrarily imposed upon them by a particular government or king. Only the Jews have this type of mesiras nefesh for our laws, and understand that when it says b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafcha, with all your heart and with all your soul, that that is really, in its final analysis, in total contradiction to v'haya im shamoa, if you choose to listen. Because the only thing that's preserved us through all of these years and generations is the attitude of the core of the Jewish people and our leaders, that there is no if at all. If there had been an if, Rabbi Akiva would have never given us anything. Yochanan ben Zakkai wouldn't have given us anything. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai wouldn't have produced what eventually everybody attributes to him. By the way, that's an interesting story also of Shimon bar Yochai. That's the time of Yehuda bar Ilai. It's an interesting story in it also. Here, one second. Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai. There was a time where after the land had been ruined after the War of Beitar, and some places resembled a desert, the survivors lived in deep poverty, yet their piety towards God was, you know, was still fervent despite their extreme circumstances, and they maintained the system of the Masifta and persisted in their efforts to pursue Torah studies. Now, at this time, here, there was somebody named, one of their leaders, Rav Yehuda bar Ilai. Now, him and his wife, they were so poor. By the way, a lot of our sages, this is interesting too, our leaders, our sages, the people that preserved their nation, came from the rich and the poor, the ignorant and the smart. Some worked, some didn't work. Our leadership came from the people. We were of the people, by the people, and for the people. That was really, there was no elitism, there was no merit, there was no nepotism, except in the Malchus Beis David, but only in the case where the person was worthy. And there's the famous story where they had to actually depose Rabban Gamliel, who was from Malchus Beis David, because they didn't like his conduct in the Masifta, the way he was conducting himself with a little bit, they felt too hard-handed. And they were looking for somebody to replace him. They actually thought about Rabbi Akiva, but they felt that in order to replace someone from Malchus Beis David, you have to take someone who can never be bullied. And the fact that he had questionable lineage, he came from Gerim, put him in a vulnerable position to take the place of someone from Malchus Beis David. And eventually, you know who they took? Harei Anochi Kaven Shivim Shana. Remember? Okay. Remember in the Haggadah? So now this 17-year-old of Elazar ben Azariah, who said Ani Kaven Shivim Shana, the reason they took such a young man is they realized that after they deposed Rabban Gamliel, this was a little later, they were going to reinstate him. They wanted to teach him a lesson. So they needed someone who then they could shift over and who wouldn't mind sharing, you know, or the position. So they took a very young man who was very talented, and eventually they did give the position back to Rabban Gamliel. But in any case, some were very rich, as we said, some were very poor. Nobody had a right to be a sage unless they were from that house. And even that house of David, they had to live up to a certain standard, or they could also be removed. It's total democracy. This is in a time where democracy didn't exist, and it didn't come to exist for thousands of years. Nobody had an inkling of running a government like this. So Yehuda ben Eli was so poor. Him and his wife had one cloak between the two of them. When she went to the market, she wore it. When he went to the house of prayer, he wore it. And you can imagine how nondescript it was of a garment that a man and a woman could both wear it. And yet his poverty did not stop him. And he would say, "Blessed is Hashem who gave me a cloak." Okay? Now he had a very positive attitude, which explains his role in the following story. The Romans, after Beitar, after the land was destroyed, started to rebuild the land. They felt the Jews were neutralized, and they wanted to make it basically into a Roman, you know, outpost, which they did for a long time. So they began building bridges and roads. So Rav Yehuda ben Eli thanked Hashem for these inventions, these innovations, and because of his positive attitude, he became the leader of the Jewish people 10 years after the fall of Beitar. So what happened was, the Romans began to change their policy. For 20 years, they devastated the land. There was no tilling, no reaping. The people couldn't pay taxes. The land was in ruins. And now that they no longer feared an uprising, they began to rebuild. The sages met and were discussing the new developments at a private meeting. Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli expressed gratitude and thanks to the Romans' achievements in rebuilding the roads and the public facilities. Rabbi Yossi remained silent. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai remarked that all the Roman efforts were for their own interest, had nothing to do with the Jews, and they wanted to get more taxes for the tolls and the bridges and the roads. Somebody heard him, reported it to the Romans, and they sentenced him to death. So he fled and hid in a cave for 13 years with Elazar, his son. Okay. Rabbi Yossi was punished by confinement in his hometown of Tzipori, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli was elevated to be the chief spokesman in all the assemblies of all the Jews. So actually it was the Romans who elevated Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli, and he took a very important position. He was necessary actually at that time. There was no Nasi in the Masifta, and they were afraid to appoint Rav Shimon ben Gamliel because he was from Beis Yehuda, and the Romans would get suspicious. So he took over at that time, and after the 13 years, when Rav Yashim Bar Yochai came out, Rav Yehuda ben Eli was still head of the Masifta. And but out of deference to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, when Rav Shimon Bar Yochai came out of hiding, Rav Yehuda was never called the Nasi, only the chief speaker. He never took the position. In any case, this, all of these stories you hear, this is all taking place at one of the most difficult times in Jewish history. But despite the fact that they were threatened by death and they died, you know how Rabbi Akiva died, you know how the Asari Haruge Malchus, this is the time period of them all. What comes clear is not how they died and how they were tortured and zet Torah, zet Chorah, this is Torah and this is a reward. That's not the legacy. The legacy is that our people will die other than let the Torah be abandoned and let the Jewish people be without leaders and without guidelines. That's the legacy of the Jewish people. That's what is incomprehensible to everybody else. And that's our life force, the b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha. And the fact that 6 million people went to their deaths doesn't mean that the Nazis we're the most powerful government on earth because they're no longer there. And it doesn't mean that the Jews, therefore, are a forgotten people. And it doesn't mean that the Torah is dead. All it means, that 6 million people went to their death, is that there's nothing anyone can do to eliminate the Jewish people, to destroy our Torah. You can kill 6 million. You can try everything you want. The Torah will live again. The mitzvahs will live again. The Jews will start again with renewed vigor. That's all that was left. That's the lesson in the end. That there's nothing you can do, because the concept of b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha is so deeply ingrained that you have to say, looking back at history, that the way the Jews have conducted themselves all these years, it's not v'haya im. We really don't think if we listen, then things will be good, but if we don't, well, that's our choice. If you look back on Jewish history, it's a story of seeing the halacha as mukhrach, absolute. There is no other way. And there's nothing that non-Jews can do to make us see it as an option. And that's really the final lesson from all of the endless persecution and our perseverance and our starting. And the fact there's more yeshivas, there's more Torah, there's more religious people. That's really the lasting legacy. So we're part of this astonishing people. And we carry this same Mesorah of these great people in our hearts. That when it comes down to it, there really is no option. And it shouldn't be, chas v'sholem, just at the time of a threat of death, but through day-to-day life. Every day, all choices and all conflicts and all situations that present themselves, our approach has to be, there really isn't anything to debate here. Should I do the mitzvah or shouldn't I do the mitzvah? It's, of course, there's handcuffed in a sense, like my grandfather always said, handcuffed to the Torah and the mitzvahs, and I threw away the key a long time ago. And there's nothing really to debate. Stop, you know, making ourselves crazy and, you know, and being conflicted. We're not conflicted. There's only one choice. That's really our Mesorah. That's why we're here today. Okay, everybody. Yeah.
I have a question. You said before that the law was supposed to be satisfied behavior.
Yes.
That wasn't happening. That's what
it does.
Can I borrow this?